and again at 11:45 on 990 Ave Maria Radio.
Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
This is D.L. Hudson. Welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. I have a very interesting guest today on Church and Culture. I have on the phone with me Dr. David Romer. David graduated from Fordham in 1964. He got his Bachelor of Science in Physics and then went on to get a Ph.D. in Physics at New York University. He worked in marketing and sales for some radiation therapy people until he became a teacher in New York City in 1984. But in 1988, he went on to copy editing and writing scientific textbooks. He's a Catholic. He's a member of the Christian Speaker Network and speaker list on the Shroud of Turin website. David, welcome to Church and Culture.
Oh, hi. How are you?
I'm good. And, you know, I invited you on the show today because you sent me an email alerting me to the fact that you're suing Columbia University, which I think is a very interesting thing to do. And just to tell our listeners the briefest background and let you fill it out, you basically sent a request to Columbia. Correct me if I'm wrong, David. You offered a lecture on, was it on the cosmological arguments specifically, or was it on anti-evolutionary point of view?
It was on the ontological argument for God's existence, and I included a handout or a lesson plan that I would hand out to the students. And I also included a link to an article I wrote on Academia.edu titled Why People Think God Caused the Big Bang.
So did you correct me when you said it was on the ontological argument and not on the cosmological?
It's on the cosmological argument.
On the cosmological, that's what I thought. And so walk us through your back and forth with Columbia University, which led to your lawsuit.
Well, what happened is that I sent the letter to the university minister, who supervises 12 ministers for the different denominations. And I got a letter from the Attorney General, that is not the Attorney General, the General Counsel of Columbia, telling me that I'd be guilty of harassment if I continued to contact.
You mean after one contact? Or how many times did you write to the university minister?
Just once to the university minister.
Just once? Right. And they oh, wow, okay.
I wanted to make it short. If I got into the whole thing, it would take too long.
Okay, so after one, you sent a letter offering your free services. And you do have a doctorate in physics and all kind of publications at Columbia University. And then you got a letter from the head counsel of Columbia saying any more communication would be considered harassment. Okay, take it from there.
That's right. Okay. So I then sent a letter of complaint to the New York State court system complaining about their ethics and was dismissed. They said that she didn't violate any ethical principles.
This was a district judge in New York metropolitan area?
No, it was the Attorney Grievance Committee.
Okay.
Which is part of the New York State Unified Court System.
Okay.
If the lawyers are something immoral or illegal, you can complain about them to the Attorney Grievance Committee.
Okay.
So they dismissed the complaint, saying that she didn't violate any of the rules for legal for the behavior of the lawyers.
Right.
Then I filed a lawsuit in the district court for violating the First Amendment of the Constitution.
And the which is freedom of speech.
Freedom of speech, and then freedom of religion. And the district judge dismissed it immediately. And then I wrote a brief to the appellate court explaining why the district judge was mistaken. And there was a response to the brief, but I didn't think it was really responsive. So then I asked for oral argument. And in my letter requesting oral argument, I didn't tell them I wanted to explain the case. I told the judges that I wanted to show the connection between this case and the other cases concerning the teaching of evolution, like the Scopes Monkey trial. And a few weeks ago, I just got the notice that the Second Circuit has agreed to listen to my oral arguments.
Well, that's fascinating, David, and I say it's quite a victory for you. But I want to make sure that our listeners sort of get the timeline straight. After your grievance was dismissed by the attorney grievance system in New York State,
right,
you filed a lawsuit regarding the First Amendment to a district court, federal district court, which was dismissed.
Right.
Then you filed a brief to the appeals court, correct?
That's correct.
Now, you got a response from them, which you said was inadequate, but was it also a dismissal?
No, the response was from the Columbia University. Their attorneys answered my brief.
Okay. And it was, basically ignored the point, right?
Yeah, and if it was anything of substance in it, I would have given a responding brief.
Right.
If it wasn't, so I simply asked for oral arguments to explain the significance of my lawsuit in connection with the teaching of evolution.
Now, was that a request that went back to the district court that dismissed your case?
No, it goes to the three appellate judges that are selected for the case,
okay.
And they have the right to refuse to listen. They don't have to do oral arguments.
But they did.
I mean, the case is fully pled. I mean, all the papers are filed, and the judges still want to see me and ask me questions about the case.
Now, when is this going to happen?
They said the first week in January.
That's fantastic.
The second week. Yes, it's amazing.
And what does Columbia think of this?
Well, that's a good question. One of the things that happened is that, in my opinion, Lee Bollinger defaulted from the case. I initially sued the general counsel and the attorney grievance committee, and then I got into a discussion with their lawyer about whether there was a cause of action. So from that conversation, I realized I should include Lee Bollinger. So in the case of Lee Bollinger, I hired a process server, and he served the summons, the amended complaint on Lee Bollinger. But the attorney for the general counsel announced his appearance for Bollinger one day before Bollinger was served the summons. So I told the court, in addition to the other things I said that he's defaulting from the case. There's no reason to think he's fighting the case. After all I want to do is give a talk at the Columbia about the arguments for God's existence. So why should he spend money fighting such a lawsuit?
Well, I noticed that you sent me, by the way, I want to remind our listeners, talking to Dr. David Romer about his lawsuit against Columbia University. It's going to be heard in oral arguments right after the beginning of the year. David, you sent me a blog post by a professor at the University of Chicago, Jerry Coyne, who basically, you know, trashed you because you had sent him a statement of the situation between you and Columbia and so forth. And then I looked at the various abuse that was heaped on you in the thread underneath. But I didn't see anybody in the thread actually take on the substance of your argument.
No, they did not. In any case, that isn't exactly what my email to Jerry Coyne said. I just mentioned in passing the lawsuit against Columbia. And then I listed four statements that support truths about evolutionary biology that the scientific establishment in the United States suppresses.
And so, you want to mention those to our listeners? I think they are human beings did not evolve from animals. Is that the list you're talking about?
That's correct.
What evolved from animals are hypothetical creatures without free will and the conscious knowledge of human beings. Natural selection only explains the adaptation of species to the environment, not common descent. And Charles Darwin contributed nothing to science. He was only a propagandist for eugenics. I would imagine it was the last one there that really got to Jerry Coyne.
Yeah, well, I attacked the article in the American Journal of Physics. So he saw those four statements, and to him, anyone who, even though they're absolutely true, all four of those statements, in his mind, someone who says those things is some kind of nut job.
Yeah, and now, let me tell you what gets, David, let me tell you what particularly piques my interest in the midst of all this, sort of the philosophical question in the middle of all this. As I told you before, I taught metaphysics at Fordham and have been a Thomist ever since my conversion, Roman Catholicism, 1984. And I, when it comes to evolution, I've never understood the claim that evolution accounts for the transformation between species or a change of species, especially when it comes to human beings, given that the distinctive characteristic of our species is its rationality, its ability to think in an immaterial manner. And that, and which of course involves, comes with it, free will.
Right.
I've never, right. You know, how can an immaterial intellect and freedom of will in a being evolve from a being that contains, possesses neither of those qualities? I've never understood that.
Well, I don't, that's where we have a kind of disagreement. I understand it perfectly. And in my pleadings, I mean, in the first place, about the common descent, if there's an explanation for common descent, no biologist says that the natural selection explains common descent. I have a number of quotations, I don't have them handy right now, from Richard Dawkins and experts in the field who make it pretty clear that the natural selection just explains the adaptation of species to the environment. After all, it takes 20 years for a single fertilized egg to produce all of the cells of the human body.
So what you're telling me, and I'm perfectly willing to be instructed,
yes,
is that I'm focusing on the wrong problem, correct?
Yes.
So I'm focusing on the issue of how human beings evolve from lower species when I should be focused on the issue of common descent. Is that correct?
No. Your mistake is that you think there's a disagreement between you and the biologists, when in fact there is not.
Tell me.
No biology textbook says that human beings evolve from animals. Because to say that, you'd have to say something about free will. And that's not a scientific concept.
Well, am I alone in thinking that biology textbooks do say that?
Yes, you're mistaken.
I mean, yeah, okay, I'm mistaken, but am I alone in being mistaken, or is that a common
mistake? No, there are other people who make the same mistake. For example, many laymen say that a billion years is a long length of time, and it's so long that you can explain common descent by you know, random mutations. But no biologist says that. That's only laymen who say it.
So what do biologists say about the origin of the human species?
They don't say anything about it. They sort of cover it up. They talk about the evolution of modern man. But I have some quotations that proves my point.
Well, I'm thinking back to those famous illustrations that were done as propaganda for Darwin in sort of the second generation, where they show the changes in appearance of gorillas, primates, evolving into human beings.
Yeah, well, they're not. Those are not peer-reviewed articles, and they're not biology textbooks, and they're not scholarly works. I have a.
So what you're telling me then, David, is that there are no serious evolutionary biologists who argue that the human species evolved from a lower species.
That's correct. I give you a quote. I have it out here. It's a quote from a biology textbook that's used by 65% of the people in the United States. Okay. It's from Reason Campbell's book on biology. So he says this in the book: "And certain properties of the human brain distinguish our species from all other animals. The human brain is, after all, the only known collection of matter that tries to understand itself. To most biologists, the brain and the mind are one and the same. Understand how the brain is organized and how it works, and will understand such mindful functions as abstract thoughts and feelings. Some philosophers are less comfortable with this mechanistic view, finding Descartes' concept of mind-body duality more attractive." Now, what this means is that Neil Campbell and Jane Rees are not making any statement about whether or not human beings evolved from animals.
Pinpoint for me your objection to evolutionary theory as it's actually taught in biology books.
I have no objection to it. It's absolutely correct. And here's another example. This supports the example that I just gave from this is from Stephen Jay Gould.
I read that. I read that quote, yes.
Well.
About natural theology and so forth.
Yeah, he's saying that, the statement is misleading because he's talking about the human soul. Well, he should be talking about free will. And what he's saying is that the Catholic Church teaches that that sometimes choosing God gives human beings free will. And he doesn't care about this. He has no objection to it because it's not a scientific concept.
So you're pressing your case against Columbia University primarily for what reason? What you want to give oral arguments, and you hope your oral arguments will convince the judges of what?
Well, I want to explain to the judges the connection between my case and the Scopes monkey trial and the other cases involving evolution, the Abernathy versus the Epperson versus Arkansas, for example.
What is a similarity of your case to the Scopes case?
Well, the similarity is that in the 20s, the governments passed laws, a number of governments passed laws making it illegal to teach that human beings evolved from animals. And this law makes no sense because no one really says that, as I just explained. The AC, in the case of the Scopes trial, the ACLU hated that law. So they provoked a test case to try to get it undone. But they didn't succeed. Scopes was prosecuted. I mean, Scopes was punished. But then the same thing happened in 1968 with Epperson versus Arkansas, where a teacher was complaining about the law, and she filed a lawsuit. And the majority, everyone agreed that it was unconstitutional, rightly so, because it's such a vague law. But but Abe Fortas wrote the main decision, and he didn't reject the law because it was vague. He rejected the law because he said that the law was based on something in the Bible. According to Fortas, it's the Bible that says that human beings did not evolve from animals, when in fact it's a biological fact.
So the fact that Columbia University denied you in the way they did your request to lecture is analogous to what happened, what was being enacted under those laws that you reference in those two cases.
Right. What's happening at Columbia is what they don't want me to do is to explain to the kids that human beings did not evolve from animals. The rest of the argument is just metaphysical hand waving.
Now, when you explain to the Columbia University students, if you ever get the chance, that human beings did not evolve from animals, is your first point going to be what you just said to me, that evolutionary biologists have never taught that in the first place?
Yes, that's right. And I proved it in my pleadings and in the articles I've written and in the lesson plan by quoting from biology textbooks and expert biologists like Stephen Jay Gould.
Well, why would somebody, somebody at the University of Chicago object to that if, he is an American biologist, Jerry A. Coyne, teaches at the University of Chicago, education Harvard, William and Mary, Guggenheim Fellow, all that. If evolutionary biologists don't teach that human beings evolve from animals, why would somebody like Jerry Coyne have any issue with what you're doing?
Well, they don't teach them peer-reviewed articles or biology textbooks, but they sort of propagandize about it. I mean, I think, if you're getting a course by, if Jerry Coyne is giving a course and you ask them, Professor Coyne, what about free will? Did human beings have free will? When you bring up the topic of free will, these biologists will either be irrational or dishonest. The irrational ones will say that free will is an illusion, and the dishonest ones will say that free will is a mystery, without explaining that there are no mysteries in science. There are only unanswered questions. In other words, it's dishonest to say free will is a mystery unless you specify that it's a metaphysical mystery. They want to cover up the fact that there's two different methods of inquiry, science and metaphysics, because metaphysics gives you the argument for God's existence.
And then what is the issue for you regarding whether or not evolution explains a common source?
You mean like where life began in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, why is that an issue for you regarding evolutionary theory?
I don't understand the question. I have no issues with evolutionary theory. I learned, as I told in emails to Jerry Coyne, I learned evolutionary biology by reading biology textbooks and peer-reviewed journals and scholarly works. And a scholarly work is one that does not mention intelligence, design, or creationism.
Yeah, natural selection explains only the adaptation of species to the environment, not common descent. Now, for you to make that point to Coyne, it seems to me there must be some evolutionary biologists who have been claiming that natural selection points toward a common descent. Is that correct?
No, they don't do it in peer-reviewed journals or scholarly works. I have quotations from Richard Dawkins where he says, that natural selection is the best way to explain the way species evolved so well adapted to the environment. He added the phrase adapted to the environment. No professional biologist is going to say that a billion years is a short length of time. It's a long length of time, and that's why it's possible for a bacteria to transform into a giraffe.
So, once again, you're pointing out the fact that the most respected evolutionary biologists in the field neither claim that human beings have evolved from animals, nor do they claim that evolutionary theory points toward a place of common descent.
Oh no, rational people, there's a lot of evidence supporting the fact that life began as a bacteria and then transformed into the animal kingdom. Rational people judge it to be true, even though it happened so rapidly.
So there is a common descent.
Sure.
But it's not proven by natural selection, is what you're saying.
No, I'm saying that we know that life evolved over a period of 100 million decades, and we ask the question, why? What caused it? And the answer is that there is no answer. It's an unsolved scientific problem. So this is where I have my an example, and they're sort of dishonest about it. You can see this in the way they respond to intelligent design. So what advocates of intelligent design say is that you can explain common descent because there's an intelligent designer. Well, what's wrong with this theory is that there's no evidence for it. It's irrational. So what scientists should say, if they were honest, they would say intelligent design is irrational. There's no evidence for it. And that could create a confrontation. Instead, what they say is it's not that good consistent with the scientific method. It's not testable. Which doesn't make any sense at all.
I'm talking with David Romer about his lawsuit against Columbia University that's going to result in oral arguments being given after the first of the year. I'll be back with David after this short break.
The Catholic Church stands on the shoulders of giants who shared the truth. Now it's our turn. Join Branches Catholic Ministries on November 18th for Regenerated 2017 at the Scotiabank Convention Center in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Speakers will address the most important question of our time. What is truth? Where do we find it? For the first time, Regenerated Youth will be hosted alongside the adult conference. Get tickets now at branchesoftheword.org.
The Ave Maria Communications Guild invites you to activate your faith. You're invited to the 45th annual Support Our Capuchin Kitchen Dinner held at Cobo Center's Grand Riverview Ballroom Friday, October 27th. All proceeds go to Detroit's Hungry. Tickets are $250 per person and include dinner, cocktails, musical entertainment, silent auction, and an afterglow event. Order tickets by calling 313-939-2001. Christ the King Parish in Ann Arbor will be offering a perinatal loss memorial mass Saturday, November 4th at their vigil mass. If you have experienced the loss of a child during pregnancy or directly after childbirth, they will be remembered at this special mass. Please contact Megan with child names or questions by November 1st by calling 734-474-2865. You can find many more events and enter your own events at our website, AveMariaRadio.net.
If you've enjoyed Father John Ricardo's gift of teaching and preaching in the past, his new book, Heaven Starts Now, is the book for you. In his inspiring and incisive way, Father John addresses the obstacles we all face in becoming mature disciples. How do we learn to forgive? How do we combat fear and understand suffering? How do we worship the Lord, love others, and surrender our lives to God? How do we become saints day by day? Order online at AveMariaRadio.net under the store tab. That's AveMariaRadio.net under the store tab.
I'm back with Dr. David Romer, filed lawsuit against Columbia University regarding the way they turned down his request to lecture there on the cosmological argument. And David, I want to turn toward your view of arguments for the existence of God. You studied with someone who is a good friend of mine, Father Norris Clark at Fordham University. He was your metaphysics teacher. And he taught you that the famous five proofs for the existence of God were not good. But if you look at the way in which the famous Thomist philosopher Etienne Gilson reframed or reformulated the argument for the existence of God, you ended up with a good rational argument but not a proof. So let's start with, what's the difference between a rational argument and a proof?
Well, with a proof, you can criticize the character of the person that disagrees. Whereas with an argument, that's not exactly the situation.
You mean like when Thomas Aquinas gives five proofs, that opens them up to...
So I can prove, for example, that a human being is an embodied spirit, and that human beings did not evolve from animals, or that I can prove that the human soul is spiritual. And the way of putting it is that human beings are indefinabilities that become conscious of their own existence. I can prove this because if you don't agree with it, I can call up your friends and families and call you names. I can say that you're being ignorant, irrational, dishonest, or stupid.
What's the difference between that and a rational argument?
Well, in an argument, you can't say that. So in the case of God's existence, I can prove that the human soul is spiritual. And then there's metaphysical hand-waving, which arrived at the existence of an infinite being. But it's just a person can say that the argument has no content and that it's contradictory, for example. So like if someone says the argument is contradictory and has no content, I can't criticize their character. It's a correct observation.
Okay. So if something's a proof, if something's truly a proof, if you don't accept it, you're an idiot.
Right.
If something's an argument and you don't accept it, you have no basis upon which to call them an idiot.
That's right.
Okay.
Now
explain to us, how did Gilson reformulate the arguments for the existence of God? Since he was, by anyone's measure, one of the greatest Thomistic scholars in the 20th century.
Well, he noticed that other people. Well, the argument is that that free will means we possess a center of action that makes us unified with respect to ourselves and separate from other beings. That means you exist and I exist, but I am not you and you are not me. That means we're finite beings, but finite beings need a cause. So, assuming or hoping that the universe is intelligible means that an infinite being exists.
Okay, could you walk us through that argument one more time, a little more slowly, so everybody can follow you?
Okay. You exist and I exist, but I am not you and you are not me. We're two different beings.
Mm-hmm.
We're finite beings. And a finite being needs a cause. And assuming or hoping that the universe is intelligible means that an infinite being exists. And in Western religions, we call the infinite being God. They have a different terminology in the Eastern and the Chinese and the Indian religions.
Well, so Jill Sahn's argument, not his proof, his argument for the existence of God is based on the free will of distinguishable finite beings.
Right.
But the key phrase is a finite being needs a cause, and is the what's unsaid there, this following, a finite being needs a cause in order to exercise free will?
No, I exist, I'm a finite being.
Are you talking about the existence of a finite being needs a cause?
Yeah, finite beings exist. I exist. I'm a finite being. I need a cause.
Okay.
I remember distinctly a conversation I had with the Father Clark about this. He was telling us that a finite being needs a cause. So I challenged him on it, and I said, well, I know why. And he said, well, what about a being that begins to exist at some point in time? So I said, what's an example of such a being? And he said, it's a hypothetical question. So I saw immediately that that the finite being needs a cause. Now, what gives the argument more content is when you analyze what a finite being is. A finite being is a composition of essence and existence. The existence is the principle that makes it exist. And the essence is the principle that limits its existence to make it the particular being that it is. And the reason this is significant is that it sheds a light on the name God gave himself in Exodus. If you remember, Moses asked God what his name was, and he said, Yahweh. Yahweh can be translated to mean, I am who am. In other words, the human...
Pure existence, pure act, accounts for, is the only way to account for the fact that there are finite beings who exist between potency and act. But let me ask you this question, David. Of course, Norrie Clark was just one of the finest men I ever met, and I'm very blessed to have spent, you know, 3 or 4 years in his presence there in the Fordham Philosophy Department. What you have said about Jill Sohn's version of the argument for the existence of God sounds to me, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, like just another way of explaining the cosmological argument.
Yes, that's exactly it.
We're just not calling it a proof. Is that the only difference?
No, the way the Stanford Encyclopedia treats the cosmological argument is only to deal with the arguments based on the gaps in science. They're called God of the Gaps arguments.
I don't want to talk about the Stanford. I agree with you about the Stanford Encyclopedia being very misleading. I'm just saying, in terms of Jill Sohn's interpretation of St. Thomas Aquinas, it just sounds to me like a restatement of the proof, but he's calling it an argument, not a proof.
I don't know. I got it from Father Clark. I didn't actually read Gilson.
Okay, same point. It sounds to me like Norrie Clark is saying, is restating one of St. Thomas's proofs, but he's calling it an argument rather than a proof.
No, because the five ways of Thomas don't mention that humans are finite beings and finite beings need a cause. He got that from the metaphysics of Thomas Aquinas. And it's not just Norris Clark. There's another professor there who gave us a very short argument for God's existence. He just said that you exist and I exist, and God is a being that's not like this.
Well, let me remind you, at least what I recall from Aquinas's cosmological argument, and he talks about contingent beings, which to my mind are the same thing as finite beings. What's the difference?
Well, a being can be contingent if it begins to exist at some point in time, and also if it's a composition of two principles. Now, a finite being is a composition of essence and existence, so that's an example of
that. But doesn't a contingent being also mean that he's composed of essence and existence? In other words, that his existence is limited by his form?
Not his form. The form has to do with the, when you're a member of a category.
Well, his essence.
The form has to do with,
limited by his essence.
Has to do with the soul.
Contingent being is existence is limited by his essence in the same way a finite being is.
Right.
So again, I love Norrie Clark, but I'm not clear that this is any different from St. Thomas's version of the cosmological argument.
Well, in the five ways, Thomas Aquinas says it has to be a first cause or a prime mover. He got it from Aristotle. He didn't think about it. He assumed that Aristotle knew what he was talking about.
Well, I mean, Aristotle did know what he was talking about for the most part.
Who?
Aristotle.
Well, Aristotle said it had to be a prime mover. But that what moved the prime mover? It doesn't make any sense. And then Aquinas picked it up and said it had to be a first cause. And it raised the question, what caused the first cause? Whereas when you say that a finite being needs a cause, then that means an infinite being exists, and an infinite being does not need a cause.
It seems to me, David, that all we're talking about is the difference between a Platonic and Aristotelian versions of arguments for the existence of God. One's from teleology, the other is from participation. And Norrie Clark was definitely belonged to the camp of the metaphysics of participation, which our listeners might think of as a vertical argument as opposed to a horizontal argument that you would find in a teleological version.
No, I don't understand what you're saying at all, but the teleological argument to me is the arguments from design, the complexity of life. That's a different
In any teleology, as you know, there are four causes. You can argue it from first, final, formal, or efficient. Enter into the argument from any of those angles.
I don't think that they're getting into those details is really important. The important thing for people to understand is that human beings are embodied spirits, and that the human soul is spiritual.
Yes, absolutely.
If someone denies that, as I said, they're either being irrational or they're lying.
That's a good point. Now, it is the immateriality of the intellect, which is I'm using immaterial here as another word for spiritual, is the difference that makes a human being a human being. Immateriality of the intellect.
I wouldn't put it that way. I prefer the word mystery.
Well, you use the word spiritual, which I assume means immaterial.
No, it doesn't mean that at all.
What does it mean?
We can come, in the case of free will, we can move our hand about any way that we want. But if we lose our hand in an accident, we continue to exist. So we ask the question, what's the relationship between myself and my body? And the answer, judged to be true by rational people and supported by the evidence, is that it's a mystery, with the understanding that there are no mysteries in science, and science is a tremendous track record of success.
Mystery is that which is potentially knowable but unknowable either by in terms of a lack of contemplation or a lack of research, or that it is a kind of knowledge that is too is beyond the grasp of certain kinds of intellects. Mystery does not mean unknowability. It's potential knowability that is as yet unrealized.
No, I don't agree with that at all.
So you think there are things that are intrinsically unknowable?
We have a drive as human beings to know and to understand everything.
Yeah, but you're saying there are certain things that are intrinsically unknowable, and that's what a mystery is.
I wouldn't put it like that. Let me put it like this. We see the sky is blue, and we ask, why is the sky blue? And they couldn't figure it out in the 19th century, but they figured it out in the 20th century.
Yeah, knowing it was a mystery in the 19th, but not in the 20th.
Right. So now knowing that the sky is blue means more than that light is entering the eye and a signal is going to the brain. It means an awareness of it. So what is that awareness? And my answer is that it's a mystery. And now you want to elaborate on what I mean by mystery. I don't see any point. The important thing is to distinguish between unanswered scientific questions and metaphysical questions.
Well, there are mysteries in metaphysics, which simply mean that there are things that are knowable by God that are not knowable by us. There are mysteries in science, which mean that science have just simply not developed to that extent to know those particular things.
That's right. So the reason most biologists are either irrational or dishonest is that they say free will is a mystery, like I'm saying, like Father Clark said. But they don't specify that it's a metaphysical mystery.
Why would you say free will is a mystery?
Because
And by the way, in what sense is it a mystery? Is it a mystery in that what allows it creates the basis for it? Is it a mystery in terms of the fact that it exists in certain types of beings, or is it a mystery in terms of how it chooses its objects?
It's a mystery because we can comprehend it, because we have it, but we can't define it. We can't say what it is. We can't answer the question, what's the relationship between myself and my body? It's a mystery.
And is free will the avenue through which we explore the relationship of the mind to the body? Is that the connection between the mind and the body?
No, there's also the question of mental beings. When I look at a tree, I can close my eyes and then create an image of the tree.
Right.
That's a mental being. What is it?
That's the first act of perception, of the imagination, of the creation of the image based upon perception.
That's circular reasoning.
How is that circular reading? I'm just describing what happened. You look at something, you perceive it, and then you close your eyes and you recreate it in your mind through an act of imaging it, of imagining it.
Right, exactly. So what is an image? Does it have mass? Does it have volume?
Is it what?
Does it have mass? Does it have volume?
No. It's part of an immaterial intellect.
I wouldn't use that phrase. I would avoid using the word immaterial.
Well, the reason I use immaterial is simply that when you use concepts like truth, right, and wrong, these are all abstract concepts that have been abstracted from human experience in a way and constructed in a way that no being who lacks an immaterial intellect would be able to do, to create concepts, abstractions.
So you think that human beings have souls, is what you're saying?
Absolutely, they have souls.
And that when they don't.
But that's a religious belief. I'm saying immaterial intellects mean just what they mean, that while a person is a living being, his or her intellect acts in immaterial ways to create concepts based upon experience, concepts which are not found in any range of perception or sensation.
Yeah, okay, that sounds good.
And that's why I was equating spiritual with immaterial. When you said spiritual earlier, I think of spiritual as that which is immaterial, but spiritual usually connotates a kind of relationship with a religious dimension.
Yeah, I don't use the term spiritual or material at all. I think they're misleading.
But I thought you used the word spiritual.
No, I used the word, I said that a human being is superior to animals because of their free will and the conscious knowledge of human beings as opposed to the sense knowledge of animals. And this creates a paradox. The paradox is that we're all equal to one another, but at the same time different. And the resolution of this paradox is that we're a composition of form and matter, or body and soul. The soul is a principle that makes us equal or a member of the class of human beings. And the body is the principle that makes us different. So a human being is a composition of body and soul. It's not that we have souls, it's that we're a composition of body and souls. And the reason we say that the human soul is spiritual is that we can comprehend what makes us superior to animals, but we can't define it. We can't answer the question, what's the relationship between ourselves and our bodies?
And when you get before these three judges in January of 2018, do you see yourself as basically presenting these kinds of arguments that you and I have had here and that I've seen in your correspondence? And what do you hope to achieve?
Well, what I'm going to start with is the quote from Stephen Jay Gould, where he says that the one about the soul. I'm going to explain why this is true scientifically, but it's very misleading because he's using the word soul instead of the word free will.
And by the way, let me quote this this quote from Stephen Jay Gould that you have. He says, Catholics could believe whatever science determined about the evolution of the human body so long as they accepted that at some time of his choosing, God had infused soul into such a creature. And you're saying that should be free will.
Right. And he doesn't want to say free will because there's that argument for God's existence based on free will. Free will means we possess a center of action. It means we're finite beings. You exist and I exist. I am not you and you are not me.
So you think he explicitly chose that word in order to defend a kind of community atheism that the evolutionists have?
They don't like to talk about free will. They don't mind talking about souls because the idea that human beings have souls is there's no evidence for it.
Do you think at the David Romer? Do you think at the end of the day you'll get your lecture at Columbia University?
It's a good question. I'm hoping is I've asked the court to write a summary. I wrote a default judgment where they tell them that the court tells the court they can't penalize me or sue me if I send emails to the Columbia community.
Absolutely.
I'm hoping that they write a decision which comes out as which we. Repeats the arguments for God's existence and repeats the fact that the Stanford Encyclopedia doesn't have it, and that they were it was wrong for them not to let me explain things to the community of Columbia.
Well, I want to wish you good luck, and I'm sure our listeners do as well. We admire the fact that you've taken on the venerable Columbia University, which some years ago was a university that taught St. Thomas Aquinas and the Summa Theologica and in its great books program. And so maybe you'll shake some bushes there and you'll find some supporters at Columbia. I want to thank David Romer for being on Church and Culture today. Thank you.
Thank you for letting me speak.
You got it. And to all of you listening, we'll have another great guest right after this message.
Exists to spread the gospel by preaching and teaching, and so it is also centered upon the study of sacred truth. I'm Father Benedict Kroll, and I'm the vocation director for the Eastern Province Dominicans. Have you ever considered a vocation to be a Dominican priest or brother? Our next vocation weekend will be November 10th to the 12th at the Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C. Contact me at 800-529-1205 or log on to DominicanFriars.org.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
Being a new mom is hard work, but you don't have to choose between caring for your baby and caring for yourself. Remember, a peaceful mom is a better mom. Make sure to sleep when baby sleeps, and be confident expecting your husband's help with both baby care and the household. No, he can't do everything either, but by being honest, you can work together to make a plan that helps you achieve better balance. Just remember, always prioritize your and your baby's well-being before housework and chores. In time, I promise you'll get on top of things, but only if you can focus on keeping your wits about you until you do. For tons of tips on balancing baby and self-care, check out Then Comes Baby, the Catholic Guide to Surviving and Thriving in the First 3 Years of Parenthood. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
Sunday's Gospel is about a party, a feast God prepares to which everyone is welcome. But we also have to learn how this feast works. I want you to consider three feasts from the scriptures. The prophet Isaiah speaks of a feast on a mountain, an all-you-can-eat buffet, a fantastic celebration. He's saying to those struggling with faith that one day God would heal every sorrow, heartbreak, and injustice. He used the idea to remind people that God is with them right now. Don't let your tears obscure his presence, he says. He urges not to let our trials and sorrows hide that presence. God is among us now. Jesus' parable tells two different stories. The first one says he always invites those to follow him. We're the ones who have a million excuses as to why we can't do it. And the second story is about being properly dressed. It's a reminder of the white garment you received at baptism. If you accept Jesus' invitation to follow him, then you have to live like a disciple. The third feast, Paul writes about in the Philippians. Even though he's in prison, Christ is feeding and strengthening him. Even in prison, Paul can still strengthen and feed others by writing and encouraging them. Now the same is true for us. We each have struggles, difficulties, and heartaches. Yet each of us has something to share: time, talent, money, life experience, wisdom. Use your abundance to help and encourage others. I'm Father Pat Egan, chaplain to Ave Maria Radio, commenting on the readings read today at Mass. Remember, inspired by the Word of God, you can be more fully alive.
Weekdays at 10 a.m., there's More to Life.
Hi, I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk.
And I'm Lisa Popchuk. Each weekday on More to Life, we'll explore the life you were meant to live through the theology of the body.
Tune in for great advice.